From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. As votes are counted and recounted in Florida, Georgia, and elsewhere, we face a great crisis in this country. That crisis is disguises.
Speaking to the Daily Caller, he said, quote, "The Republicans don't win, and that's because of potentially illegal votes. When people get in line that have absolutely no right to vote and they go around in circles, sometimes they go to their car, put on a different hat, put on a different shirt, come in and vote again."
Yes, Donald Trump, who's been lying about rampant voter fraud since before his own 2016 victory, asserts that Democrats appeared at the polls in costume to cast multiple fraudulent votes. This is where the media like to use the phrase,
without evidence.
The president offered actually no evidence to back up his claim. And keeping him honest, that's probably because there isn't any.
There is no evidence of fraud, no proof of sabotage of any kind.
Yes, without evidence, without plausibility, but not without effect. In his constant, totally made-up allegations of voter fraud, which his own presidential commission imploded trying to even make a case for, Trump has successfully created a trope, a standard accusation for explaining any electoral challenge.
The growing drama over the midterms as Florida Governor Rick Scott files a bombshell lawsuit accusing Democrats of trying to steal the election.
The Kemp team has dismissed these lawsuits as trivial, and they say the Democrats are simply trying to steal the election through the court system.
Oddly, the leader so far in the vote count for Georgia's governorship, Brian Kemp, doesn't mention his systematic suppression of likely Democratic voters before the election in his then role as Georgia Secretary of State. 53,000 mostly minority voters were disqualified over trivial mismatches in registration information, such as missing middle initials. That was a scheme by the Republican candidate himself for his own electoral benefit. And this is the guy now screaming theft, because he can, because Fox News, Breitbart, Sinclair, The Daily Caller, and the rest of the GOP propaganda machine are inculcating their audiences with the false narrative, Fox's Tucker Carlson.
Now, so you even mentioned the possibility of illegal voting, and the left pretends, well, that's not real. It's not even possible. Of course, they know better, because, again, it's happening. They're lying, because voter fraud benefits them.
Say it over and over, and for many in your audience, it becomes the truth. Thus, these fraudulent accusations will achieve exactly what they intend, to undermine citizens' faith in their most fundamental right. The rhetoric claims to protect the sanctity of the democratic process, but it is merely the devil in disguise. Consider this 2012 piece from a local NBC affiliate in Miami that ran with the headline, "Nearly 200,000 Florida Voters May Not Be Citizens." The story was quickly debunked. The correct number in the end turned out to be 85, and they were removed from the rolls with no effect on the election that drew 12 million votes. But the false narrative still lives, because the people who say the mainstream media deliver fake news, when convenient, use those very news organizations to validate political lies. A host of right-wing bloggers, tweeters, junk news sites, and no less a statesman than Donald Trump Jr. himself, tweeted that old, discredited NBC headline as if it were a current story proving their voter fraud big lie. Will Sommer, who writes about the pro-Trump media for the Daily Beast, has been tracking the conspiratorial buzz surrounding Florida's recount. Will, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
As you wrote, the furor around the Florida ballot count has transformed the parking lot outside the Broward County Board of Elections office into a kind of Woodstock for the R. the Donald set. Okay, that's the pro-Trump subreddit. What did you witness there?
Witnessing from afar by a live stream and Twitter and all that, the Florida ballot count, especially in Broward County, attracted all sorts of right-wing oddballs, people looking to stir up questions about the legitimacy of the election, as well as people who are sort of looking to promote themselves and their PayPal accounts along the way.
One of them was a U.S. congressman.
That's right, Matt Gaetz from Northern Florida. This is not his district. Matt Gaetz basically is laying out this idea that the 2018 election in Florida is an elaborate dry run.
If the Democrats are able to learn now what techniques work and don't work, what transparency laws are going to be followed and which ones aren't, then it gives them a roadmap on how to steal the election from Donald Trump in 2020.
He stood with a big pack of fake ballots that was meant to imply the Democrats were inventing ballots.
You mentioned PayPal accounts. Tell me about Ali Alexander.
Ali Alexander is one of these kind of right-wing internet creatures. He told his followers, we can't trust the GOP to not let the Democrats steal this election. So he goes down there and he's saying, you know, send me money and I'm going to stop Bill Nelson from stealing this election. Some members of the Proud Boys, the far-right Western chauvinist organization, were there. Laura Loomer, who's also a right-wing internet personality, was there. So it really became, you know, quite a circus in that parking lot.
What about the bomb threat?
A couple days ago at the Fort Lauderdale airport, there was a suspicious package. So the sheriff's office went out there, and various right-wing characters saw this as proof that the sheriff himself was faking a bomb threat in order to sort of cover up the destruction or the creation of ballots.
There was some video shared by a congressional candidate named Tim Canova on Twitter.
Look, this lady is bringing ballots out of her car.
It's grainy footage that looks like it's shot outside what might be a board of elections or a polling place. It's dark, and people are carrying boxes.
I'm not real sure what's going on here.
But it's really unclear, or even whether these are ballots these people are carrying. Tim Canova is not exactly the most credible person. He is a Seth Rich conspiracy theorist.
This is the member of the Democratic Committee staff in Washington who was murdered on the street, and right-wing memes have it, against all police conclusions, that he was murdered by the Democrats themselves for something or other.
Right. The implication is exactly that Hillary Clinton killed him, you know, for various shadowy reasons. So Tim Canova has promoted these conspiracy theories. And despite him not being very credible, Republicans really ran with this video. And that, in many ways, is sort of what started the focus on Broward County. Marco Rubio, among others, jumped on this video and said, you know, this proves it all.
We actually get a glimpse of the supposed smoking gun ballot box video in an ad that was run by the right-wing super PAC Great America Alliance.
In the liberal strongholds of Broward and Palm Beach counties, ballots appear to be moved in private vehicles, and nearly 100,000 more ballots mysteriously appear. Elections that were all but over suddenly need a recount. No one should be surprised. Broward County Elections Chief Brenda Snipes has a disturbing history of controversy and scandal.
Brenda Snipes is the supervisor of the Board of Elections in Broward County. She has become sort of the great nemesis of Republicans who claim that she's stealing the election.
Why does she still have a job?
Brenda Snipes does not appear to be the most efficient operator of a Board of Elections. She's had some controversies with the ballot counts in the past. She was asked during this election cycle why it's taking so long to count the ballots.
But other counties have been able to do it.
But other counties didn't have 600,000.
And someone said, well, Miami has more people than we do, and they had no trouble with their ballots.
But it's a serious issue. It always seems like it is.
It's a serious issue with me.
She is conveniently flummoxed and also, I would say, conveniently black.
We've seen time and again Republicans focus on women or people of color, and especially women of color, in a way that I think is often disproportionate to their prominence within the Democratic Party. For example, Maxine Waters or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez really get latched onto as these big villains on the right.
But is there any evidence, and is it even possible in her capacity for her to somehow influence the count?
In the Florida state government, of course, which is stocked with Republicans and Rick Scott loyalists, they've come out and they've said they've seen no evidence that there's any fraud going on here.
I want to come back to that NBC story we discussed, the local Miami NBC story, about these supposedly unlawful 200,000 voters. It was appropriated by Donald Trump Jr. and the rest of the right-wingosphere. But in the last couple of days, something happened. Tell me what.
The local news station there, after being pressed by a former Snopes editor, they added to the headline, this story is from 2012, realizing that people often don't look beyond the headline or beyond what they see on social media, making clear to people that this is an old story and not relevant to anything in 2018.
Well, hat tip to Brooke Binkowski for intervening in that one. Now, there is one thing that seems qualitatively different from past Trump options. I mean, we're used to the trolls and we're used to the right-wing media going all in on these red herrings. But the apparent senator-elect of Florida, Rick Scott, who was governor of Florida, himself went all in. Likewise, Brian Kemp in Georgia. Could it be that we are headed towards a world of questioning every election as kind of mainstream Republican thought?
I think it absolutely does. I mean, we're seeing everyone from the candidates themselves to Marco Rubio, one of the most prominent Republican senators in the country. And I think a lot of this does derive originally from Trump, who is a famous birther conspiracy theorist, among other conspiracy theories he believes in. He's sort of legitimized the idea of going maybe a little kooky on the right in terms of your political ends. And I think it's decades of conspiracy theories, decades of Republican attacks on institutions like the media and academia that have sort of driven Republican voters into a place where they're reluctant to believe in establishments that are outside the right-wing media and the GOP themselves. Additionally, I think the internet and social media really speeds a lot of this stuff up and makes it possible for people to find other people who are going to reinforce their beliefs, no matter how ludicrous they may be.
Will, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Will Sommer writes about the conservative media for the Daily Beast and for his weekly newsletter, Right Richter.
Stephen Wright said, "It was wrong that only one company makes the game Monopoly." Coming up, how long before Amazon's the only game in town?
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the envelope was opened.
Amazon now making it official. The company setting up shop in Long Island City, Queens for one of its two new headquarters. The headquarters will be split between Long Island City
and Northern Virginia, investing $5 billion, creating more than 50,000 jobs.
After 14 months of salivating and serenading and surrendering, New York and Virginia, who between them offered more than $2 billion in givebacks to Jeff Bezos, walked away with halvesies of the Amazon HQ2 sweepstakes. After a brief period of elation, buyer's remorse began to settle in. Politicians such as New York City Councilman Jimmy Van Bramer's signaled the backlash.
With a mass transit crisis, with a public housing crisis, with a million different things that we could have used this money for, the governor and the mayor conspired secretly to cut a deal.
This was not an unpredictable reaction. Yet such voices of skepticism were scarcely heard for the previous year because the media were too excited by the drama of it all. 238 cities competing for 50,000 jobs and $5 billion investment in a winner-take-all jackpot. Irresistible. It was an orgy of supplication, reminding different observers of different things.
It feels a bit like a bid to host the online retail Olympics.
Me, I saw breathlessness, partly reminiscent of lottery fever.
Ahead of tonight's record-breaking $1.6 billion Mega Millions drawing.
And partly something much darker. Those Depression-era dance marathons where the desperate submitted to public degradation for a slim chance at a jackpot.
They're finding considerable difficulty keeping their feet in shape, but they're still going.
You think we can stick it out, Frankie?
Oh, you betcha. We're going to anyway, till the end.
I want this darn thing to end.
That was Frankie and Betty in 1931. Here was New York Governor Andrew Cuomo last week.
Anything else I can think of that'll get us over the top, anything they want named Amazon, I'll change my name to Amazon Cuomo if that's what it takes.
Well, be careful what you wish for, Governor Amazon. For better or worse, your name will be tied to HQ 1.5 forever. But if it all comes to grief, the media will also have to ask themselves hard questions about why they spent 2 years failing to ask hard questions. David Dayan, for one, isn't waiting. He's an investigative fellow within These Times and contributes to The Intercept and The New Republic and has been writing about the Amazon Mega Billions jackpot.
The two winners ended up being two cities that Amazon needs to be in. They have a lot of government contracts, so it makes sense for them to be in Washington. They have a burgeoning media and advertising empire, and so it makes sense for them to be in New York. Jeff Bezos has a large home in New York, a large home that he just bought in Washington, and he also owns the local paper in Washington. This was not really a contest, and the other 236 cities gave up very valuable information for a pipe dream.
One of the reasons the bids were expensive to prepare is that they contained more than just zoning plans and tax abatement offers. They included all kinds of very granular data about the various cities' economic development plans. Now, we know that if you know where the highway interchange is going to go in advance and buy land to build a gas station and a restaurant or whatever, you are going to make out like a bandit.
This is perhaps more valuable than the $2.5 billion or however much they got from New York City and Washington. You have logistics operations, convenience stores that you want to put up all over the country, these physical bookstores that you're putting in. If you know where the people are going to be, obviously that is going to be a real jackpot for you.
You're just supposing, right? You know of no plans to exploit the data in those particular ways, right?
Right. What we know is that over the last year, since the bids have come in, Amazon has done 15 or 16 deals for distribution centers and data centers that have netted them $230 million. And some of those cities were cities that put up bids for HQ2. And yes, it is speculative that they're going to use this data, but Amazon runs on data. It's really not a stretch to think that they're going to exploit a giant data set that they just picked up from 230-odd cities all over America.
Now, there's a whole other aspect of this kind of economic subsidy or corporate welfare, whatever you want to label it. The bet is that the value to the overall economy of the region, having thousands of new taxpayers and opportunities for local commerce, that all outweighs the government investment in the form of tax abatement and maybe infrastructure build out. Over the decades, have these bets paid off?
Well, I think the way to look at it is to step back a little. Maybe one municipality is benefiting by an individual deal, but is the entire country benefiting from this race to the bottom between cities where they just throw themselves at various companies and give them all these cash awards? I think the answer is clear. The annual cost of these economic development subsidies, by one measure, is something like $90 billion. And that is not really sustainable. You're talking about something that's more than a lot of municipal budgets and more than the cost of things like housing subsidies. You're just shifting money from government into the hands of companies who have to site their location somewhere. Studies have shown that this just displaces jobs within a particular metro area, that a company comes in and other companies end up moving out. So it does not become this big job creator. It's just a series of corporate giveaways with no real economic benefit.
We had some evidence in the midterms last week that the public itself may be growing suspicious of this sort of deal. Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, lost in the election partly due to the sweetheart deal that he put together for Foxconn, the electronics manufacturer.
Certainly the Foxconn deal, which seemed to shift after it was signed. Foxconn said they were building one type of plant that would need a certain type of worker, and suddenly they don't need as many manufacturing jobs. That definitely was a factor in the election. It was one of Tony Evers, who's the governor-elect's first ads, was talking about Foxconn. And I do think that you're seeing a lot of opposition to this HQ2 deal within city governments in New York and the state government in Virginia. There are members that are very distressed about the lack of transparency, the sheer size of the deal, and about these impositions on democracy. In the Amazon deal, they are allowed by the state to run a protective order if information under the Freedom of Information Law in Virginia is attempted to be released by the state. In Virginia, the state is obligated to have a light touch on regulation on Amazon, and that's in the deal. All of these things, I think, are souring people on this idea that economic development is only about throwing subsidies at companies.
There's one last thing, David. Look, you aren't exactly an adherent of the Chicago School of Economics. You're not a Milton Friedman acolyte. You are an unabashed lefty with deep suspicions about capital and corporate welfare and so on. Weren't you certain to sneer at any ultimate Amazon deal? Is there any evidence that's pertinent to this case that you're withholding to make your case?
Well, certainly adherence to this style of economic development would say that the tax revenues that come in from a large company locating outweigh the cost, that the deal pays off in a certain number of years. But there are other ways to do economic development. If you want your city to be an attractive option for large companies to locate, you could use all this money that you're spending on subsidies and put it towards educating the workforce, improving the infrastructure, housing affordability. And suddenly, companies will think, oh, that looks like a good place to be. I'm going to move my location there. Chattanooga, Tennessee decided that a priority is going to be municipal broadband. They have this ultra-fast, ultra-cheap broadband, and companies that need to be in a global economy using the internet have flocked to that city. So that's another way to do this kind of economic development. And I don't know, left or right, it seems like spending that money on people and improvements in the city and quality of life, rather than giving the money away to a corporation, might unite the left and right against this kind of crony capitalism.
David, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
David Dayan is an investigative fellow with In These Times and contributes to The Intercept and The New Republic. He's author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud.
Since Amazon's founding in 1994, it's taken over industry after industry. What we buy and how we buy. Stacey Mitchell is the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Earlier this year, she wrote an article for The Nation called Amazon Doesn't Just Want to Dominate the Market, it wants to become the market. To explain where we now stand in the arc of antitrust, she begins America's relationship with monopolies with the rise of the railroads and how the industrialists that owned the tracks, the cars, the wheels of commerce extorted money from small businesses and farmers and blocked competitors from accessing the market.
And so it was the railroads, this very disruptive new technology of its time, that really led to the first movement for antitrust laws. And in 1890, we got the passage of the Sherman Act. But the Sherman Act wasn't really enforced. And so the problem of concentration continued to grow. In the 1910s, under the Woodrow Wilson administration, Louis Brandeis, who later served on the U.S. Supreme Court, was active as an architect of the Federal Trade Commission Act, the Clayton Act, other monumental antitrust laws. But again, those laws weren't really activated. It wasn't really until the Great Depression, particularly in Roosevelt's second term in 1936, he ran on this platform where he said, you know, the problem is that too much power has been concentrated in the hands of too few.
They had begun to consider the government of the United States as a mere appendage to their own affairs. And we know now that government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob.
He hires this small-town lawyer and mayor from Wyoming, Thurman Arnold, to run the antitrust division of the Department of Justice. Congress and Franklin Roosevelt had created something called the Temporary National Economic Commission, but it was popularly known as the Monopoly Commission.
Mm-hmm.
The Monopoly Commission met for 2 years and took testimony from over 500 people and was documenting all of the ways in which concentration had increased across various industries. Thurman Arnold decided to open field offices across the country to be kind of the eyes and ears on the ground. Arnold made Monopoly front page news.
And a lot of this public engagement resulted in legislation.
Congress passed in 1936 the Robinson-Patman Act, which is a very important piece of antitrust legislation. It was designed to prevent large retail companies, primarily like AMP, the big grocery chain, from being able to use their power over suppliers to disadvantage their smaller competitors. Today, we no longer enforce Robinson-Patman Act, and we haven't for decades.
It seemed like the steam had sort of gone out of the antitrust movement.
In the 1960s and 70s, antitrust enforcement continues to be strong, but monopoly begins to fade from the public discussion. It's no longer in the newspapers. It's no longer in State of the Union addresses. And that really sets the stage for what I think it's fair to call the coup that happens in the 1980s.
Robert Bork wrote something called the antitrust paradox, which became something of a Bible or a blueprint or a manifesto.
Bork was a leader of this group of legal and economics scholars who came along with a radically different view of how we should approach antitrust. All of those previous decades, antitrust had very much embodied this idea that the core purpose was to protect democracy, that concentrated economic power was a threat to us as citizens, and that it was about protecting us as producers of value, as workers, as entrepreneurs, as innovators. Bork came along and he said, this is not what antitrust should be about. Antitrust should be entirely pointed towards maximizing efficiency and maximizing the output of the economy. He had this notion that bigger companies were naturally more efficient, and therefore antitrust should actually look favorably upon mergers and combinations. He really inverted antitrust. He turned it on its head.
When you were talking at the beginning of all of this about the railroads, I was thinking of the article you wrote that was headlined, Amazon doesn't just want to dominate the market, it wants to become the market.
To think of Amazon as a retailer is really to misunderstand the nature of this company. Amazon's goal is to control the underlying infrastructure of the economy. More than half of all product searches now begin on Amazon. And what that means is for every other company in the economy that wants to sell consumers something, they have to become sellers on Amazon's platform in order to reach the market.
And because they have to go on Amazon's platform, Amazon can, you might say, extort all sorts of promises and concessions from them.
Birkenstock has complained to Amazon for years that there are lots of counterfeit Birkenstocks on its site. And so they've said, clean up these counterfeit shoes. And Amazon said, we can police those counterfeits, but you're going to have to agree to our terms. Birkenstock, like a lot of retailers, reserves its very new and special products for brick-and-mortar retailers to help those stores be competitive. Well, Amazon wants to go after the business of those brick-and-mortar stores. And so it said to Birkenstock, yeah, we'll be happy to clean up the counterfeits, but you have to sell all of your shoes to us, your full line. The only way we know that this happened is that Birkenstock actually went public and said, we are not doing this. We're going to withdraw from doing any business with Amazon. But it looks like a lot of other companies, including Nike, have faced a very similar kind of strong-arm tactic where Amazon has used counterfeits to get suppliers to do what it wants and has succeeded.
And what is Amazon's effect on politics and on civic engagement?
I mean, from the very beginning, Amazon has benefited from tax breaks that are not available to its competitors. Its warehouses have been financed with over $1.2 billion in public subsidies. Last year, its supporters in Congress put an amendment into the defense authorization bill that was known around the Hill as the Amazon Amendment, because it directed the federal government to contract with an online e-commerce portal for the purchase of all of the supplies and commercial goods that it uses. And as Amazon has grown, we've seen a sharp decline in the number of small businesses, and we've seen a collapse in new business formation. We're also losing an economy that's built on relationships and the notion of face-to-face interaction. What sociologists have found is that places that have this vibrant, locally-based economy are actually healthier on a variety of measures of social and civic health. People actually know their neighbors more than people who live in communities without a lot of local businesses. They belong to community organizations in greater numbers. And they also actually vote in greater numbers, all else being equal, than people who live in places where the local economy has really been hollowed out.
This recent poll by the Knight Foundation and Georgetown University found that Amazon is ranked the most trusted institution among Democrats and the third most trusted among Republicans?
It's an indication partly of how well Amazon has managed its public image. Amazon very much fears on the left the potential that a Democratic Congress and administration might actually exercise antitrust authority to break up Amazon. And, you know, this fall, when they were facing all of this pressure from Bernie Sanders around their low wages in their warehouse,
thousands of Amazon employees are forced to rely on food stamps, Medicaid, and public housing because their wages are just too low.
And also facing a very tight labor market where they knew they were going to have to bring on a lot of people for the holiday shopping season. I think Jeff Bezos looked at that moment and very astutely said, I can solve my need to hire for the holidays and perhaps stave off growing concerns about Amazon's power by setting this $15 an hour minimum wage. It was an announcement that produced very glowing headlines. I think the other thing that is so striking to me about that poll is it's really an illustration of how much government feels to most people like it just doesn't work for them anymore. Increasingly, when they think about who's going to solve their problems, they're sort of looking to corporations. One of the other things that it made me think about was the response that I got to that article in The Nation. The article addresses readers entirely as citizens, and yet virtually every message that I got from someone, they responded from a consumer framework.
Huh.
The response was, we should organize a boycott. I'm going to tear up my Prime membership. These responses get to the crux of the very thing that I was raising in the article, which is that 40-some years ago, we began to adopt this consumer framework, and we've internalized it so much that when we think of questions like the power of corporations, we take the standpoint of the consumer. And of course, as a consumer, Amazon is incredibly convenient. There are a lot of great things about it. But it's not coincidental that this rise of the consumer identity and this loss of our citizen identity coincides with a period in which we've had rising inequality, where we felt like we've really seen this sort of weakening of government as it's been increasingly co-opted by corporate interests.
What do you propose?
Separate Amazon as a platform for commerce from Amazon as a retailer and a manufacturer. And the only way to do it is to break Amazon up into at least two pieces. Amazon as infrastructure that other companies rely on, we need to treat that as a kind of common carrier. That is, that if you're going to run the infrastructure that other companies need in order to reach the market, that there is a set of standards that you have to comply with.
So what do you think? Are you seeing a real resurgence in public awareness of the impact of monopoly and corporate concentration? Or are you just wishing it were so?
Monopoly is being talked about again. There are a growing number of economists who are finding in their research that rising levels of income inequality seem to be quite directly connected to rising levels of corporate concentration. These consolidated companies are really effectively able to hold down wages. We've also seen this collapse in new business formation. You know, we're creating new businesses at only about one-third the rate that we were in the 1980s. You know, we think we're a nation of startups, but we really aren't anymore. Senator Elizabeth Warren has talked about the importance of resurrecting our antitrust laws.
It is time for us to do what Teddy Roosevelt did, pick up the antitrust stick again. And sure, the stick has collected some dust, but the laws are still on the books.
And we're seeing it not just on the left, but also on the right.
I want to implore my fellow conservatives, keep investing in antitrust. Embrace it as an area of the law in which we speak to the power of the markets by speaking to the importance of sound regulation.
You have farmers across the Midwest who are railing against the power of big meat packers and Monsanto.
And don't forget the antiquarian booksellers. As we talk, 250 of them from 24 countries are protesting an Amazon site called Abe Books for banning their businesses on the platform because of, quote, increasing costs and complexities.
That's right. Independent businesses of all kinds are beginning to speak out, you know, booksellers, toy retailers, hardware dealers. I do think that there is a growing anti-monopoly movement, and the fact that we're using that word again is incredibly encouraging.
Stacey, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke. It was great to be with you.
Stacey Mitchell is the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance.
Coming up, Sears was once a big-time market disruptor, a proto-Amazon, and its relentless pursuit of customers took a big bite out of Jim Crow.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Now we move from pondering the impact of a relatively recent retail disruptor to the decline of a very old one. This week, Great American Capital Partners agreed to lend $350 million at a steep rate of interest to Sears, enabling it to stay afloat this holiday season after it filed for bankruptcy last month. Sears also announced the closure of some 142 stores. But before its brick-and-mortar business, it was a catalog, one that sold everything from underwear to bungalows in a box. Lewis Hyman is an economic historian and professor at Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. When news of the bankruptcy broke, he tweeted that, quote, "What most people don't know is just how radical the catalog was in the era of Jim Crow." It sparked a huge response. Sears was radical? A driver of racial equality?
Yeah, in the 1890s, 1900, most African Americans were still living in the country. Not until 1960 are more African Americans living in the cities. They lived as sharecroppers. They lived as tenant farmers. And they shopped at the local country store. That gave them access to a wider world of goods, access to credit, which they needed because they were only paid once a year during the harvest came in, just like white farmers as well.
Wow.
But they had a very unequal access to the space. Of course, it was the era of Jim Crow, which started in 1890 in Mississippi.
Describe how that plays out in the real world.
The trick with Jim Crow was that it was everywhere all the time. When African Americans would go into a train station, a country store, anywhere really, they would have to wait until all white patrons were served. The country store wasn't like stores today where you serve yourself. Everything has to be done by a clerk at the counter who decides whether or not you actually deserve what you're asking for because it's all on credit. So the shopkeeper decides if you're the kind of person who should have that quality of shirt. And African Americans didn't really have much choice. Every interaction was a rehearsal of hierarchy and deference, a rehearsal of Jim Crow.
I was reading a piece in the Washington Post where they talked about white supremacy playing out in the way that you say. In fact, it would be disturbing that a black person could have something in their home that's as nice as what you have in yours, say.
Yeah, that really is what African Americans saw as so liberating in access to the catalog.
Right, because prior to the catalog, there was only the country store, right?
It was a monopoly. Then suddenly you could order things out of the catalog on credit, just like at your store, and they were cheaper. And most importantly, they were just as good as anything else that a white person would get out of that catalog.
By 1908, one-fifth of Americans received that catalog. The podcast 99% Invisible cited a figure that suggests at its peak, the catalog offered 100,000 items on 1,400 pages.
Does fighting traffic when you shop almost make you blow your top? Put an end to traffic fears. It's very easy to get to Sears.
Just imagine if you had never left that plot of land in your entire life and you opened up this big fat tome and you could see what people in Chicago, that faraway town, were wearing and eating, buying for themselves, and just imagine yourself in a different world. And this is a time when, for African Americans, imagining Chicago was a politically dangerous act, that the Chicago Defender, one of the most important African American newspapers in America, was contraband in the South. It had to be smuggled from person to person, from church to church. In a lot of ways, the catalog was like that as well. It was some sort of a radical imagination outside of the life you were told you belonged in and you would always have. You know, it's a very conservative impulse. Do I get the right to spend my money in capitalism, right? How do you argue with that?
Conservative with a small C.
Yeah, but at the same time, a very radical act when you're challenging a white supremacist order.
You observe that the catalog was geared towards illiterate people, whether they were Swedish or African Americans.
They were trying to sell to as many people as possible at a distance in rural America, trying to break the mold of all older business models, and they did it.
The Washington Post pointed to an article in the Libertarian Reason magazine.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? How Sears has been credited with the creation of the Delta Blues?
This is quite a claim, and historians have talked about this, that access to guitars,
steel string guitars from Sears,
cheap, you know, affordable, high quality, made this possible. And, you know, it seems entirely possible that access to, you know, guitars are expensive. So, you know, what a rich history to think about this sort of cultural creation that comes out of this catalog.
You described how the general store, which often also functioned as the post office, would sometimes refused to sell money orders to black families.
White store owners were very serious about maintaining control. So what Sears did was put out orders that you could just talk to a postman. You could skip the post office entirely. There were all kinds of ways to subvert that system if the postman was willing to get access to this national market.
You know, what really shocked me was how acknowledged the subversive power of the Sears catalog was, that there were bonfires of Sears catalogs in places.
Absolutely. They set all kinds of reward systems. If you turned a catalog in and had it destroyed, trying to defend Jim Crow in the name of small business.
Now, at the time, there was a rumor that both Sears and Roebuck,
that's right,
were black. It reminded me of anti-Semites claiming that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was Jewish. Sears himself published pictures of himself to prove that he was white. I assume that this was purely a business gesture, right?
Yeah, but I think it shows you how radical the catalog was, and especially as the way it contested the racial order.
Which is really interesting also because it was back in 1895 that Roebuck sold his share of the business, and Julius Rosenwald became part owner of the company.
Julius Rosenwald's an interesting character because he was a small-time suit manufacturer And one day, Richard Sears walks in and orders 500 suits. And he's like, what are you talking about? You're never going to sell that many. And he says, I already sold them. And so that's how they got into business together. And Julius Rosenwald really helped him expand the business.
He was a huge philanthropist to the Black community, donating more than $4 million, roughly the same as $75 million today, to open nearly 5,000 schools in the rural South, where many African-American kids couldn't go to school.
Separate but equal was never equal. Separate but equal was always better schools for white kids. Mm-hmm. And these were schools that were good for Black kids.
So what new things did you learn from the big reaction to your tweet?
A lot of people shared their stories of shopping while Black, especially young people being watched in stores, but also people who were trans talking about having access to clothes that maybe didn't fit their perceived gender identity. In a lot of ways, Amazon today is very much like the Sears Roebuck catalog of yesteryear. Also in the way it employs cheap labor. The Sears Roebuck catalog, the goods in it were made possible by the sweatshops of Chicago, immigrants being exploited. So it's not an unambiguous story of positivity, but it is a story of access. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something to consider as we think about what digital capitalism means in the 21st century.
What does it tell us?
I think it tells us that there is real value in having access to markets, particularly for people who are confined spatially or economically. Certainly in the long history of America, African Americans have always been spatially segregated, and their retail lives reflect that. So, mm-hmm. The classic study from the 60s, the poor pay more, that African Americans didn't have access to the same kinds of goods that white suburbanites had. People simply used the catalog to fight against white supremacy.
And did you find that at all ironic? As a historian of capitalism, you've probably spent a lot of time staring down some of its fundamental flaws and injustices. And you've observed that democracy has long been constrained by racism. Is this a case of capitalism to the rescue?
It's certainly a case of market competition to the rescue. What's surprising to me as a historian is that Jim Crow faced down consumer capitalism and Jim Crow lost. And in the first Civil Rights Act, it wasn't about voting. It was about consumer access. It was about shopping. Equal access to stores, equal access to trains, equal access to restaurants and hotels and movie theaters. I think for many of my students, when I teach this class, it's easy to not really care that much about voting. You vote every couple of years, but every single day you use a bathroom. Every single day you go somewhere. And to think about, oh, that is what Jim Crow meant. It's an everyday kind of thing.
It doesn't really bother you that Sears is falling apart, right? I mean, it's survival of the fittest. Amazon did to Sears what Sears did to the general store.
I worry for the workers, hundreds of thousands of workers at Sears that are going to lose their jobs. But I do think that it's part of a broader reconfiguration of retail. And in the next few years, we're going to see that happen. The book I just released was largely about this reshaping of the American landscape and the insecurity of work. And I think that's the story that's here. Even as we want to focus on the consumer experience, we should also be focusing on the employee experience.
I mean, it may be that we all end up shopping at one company for, the next couple of generations.
For a generation. I mean, that's what's sort of interesting. I mean, there also is a long history of how the chain stores took over, first the catalog, then the chain store, then the mall. There's been this succession of different kinds of retail in American history. So I think we shouldn't lament the death of one kind of retail. We should figure out how we can make this new kind of retail, this new kind of economy work for everybody.
I'm not so much worried about a new kind of retail as I am about one company dominating all retail online. And I say this as someone who has a Prime account.
Yeah, no, I think there are people who are very concerned about monopoly and monopsony. And
monopsony?
Monopsony is where there's only one buyer as opposed to only one seller.
Uh-huh.
So in America, Walmart is a monopsonist. They're the only buyer for a large swath of Chinese factories, so they can drive down prices. We actually live in a monopsony economy right now. So Amazon, Walmart, and we're not talking as much about that as we can because it's such a strange word.
I love it. Thank you so much, Lewis.
It's my pleasure.
Lewis Hyman is the author of Temp: How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Asta Chaturvedi. We had more help from Samantha Maldonado, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.